thank you so much. Can you hear me back there? I was advised that my voice might not carry, and I don't want you to miss a word of this, because this is, it, you know, you've had five good talks, and that makes bingo. And this might not be quite so good. But egotistically, I'll say that I'll do the very best I can, and may I thank you, Mr. Chairman, and all of you ladies and gentlemen up here, but mostly you folks out there. You know, there's only three kinds of alcoholics. The handsome, the intelligent, and us. That's the main three. My name is Bill W., Bill White, and I'm from the 24-hour group in Dublin, Georgia. Macon is one of the subdivisions of our fair city, and Atlanta is one of the suburbs. But we have a wonderful city over there. Before I go too far here, I'd like to bring my, you know, Father Joe last night brought in something about the preacher that was here. We have a wonderful Methodist preacher here tonight. And I wonder if he was reading and carrying along with our recent conference in Atlanta when one of our young preachers was sent up into the North Georgia hills to begin his pastorate. And the bishop told him, you only have 35 members in this church. It's up to you to double that membership in 12 months. I'll be there 12 months from today, and I want you to have that membership doubled. Well, the young fellow worked hard, and he doubled the membership. But on the night before the conference day, when the bishop was coming, it had a terrible blizzard. The rain, the storm, the snow came, and only four new members showed up on Sunday morning. Well, the bishop would accept no excuses. And he got up and preached a sermon that morning and castigated and low-rated this young fellow something terrible. Finally, after this great excruciating sermon was over, the young fellow got up to close the service, and he said, I want all of you to understand one thing here today, that your joining this church, becoming members of this congregation, without further to do, will not keep you from going to hell. He says, the fact that I am a minister of the gospel, it's found in the truth, it's found in the good book, will not keep me from going to hell. And as far as a bishop is concerned, he can go to hell too. No. You know, about three Sundays ago, I had a radio program on Sunday morning, Sunday school lesson, and I was downtown getting a shoe shine. And I realized that my time for going on the air was imminent. I had to go. I realized I didn't have time to walk back around to the church, and I run out and called a cab there that was parked. I called him. I said, how about running around the church? He said, I'm sorry, I'm not taking any fares right now. He said, I'm going to listen to the judge on the radio in my cab. And I said, well, I got to get there. And I pulled out my billfold and placed a $5 bill. And I said, I got to go. He looked up and he saw that $5. He said, the hell with the judge. Where you want to go? So it worked sometimes. But I am an alcoholic from over in Middle Georgia. I'm right proud that I'm from over there tonight, because I've enjoyed the wonderful meal, enjoyed the fellowship and hospitality of the Mississippi delegation, and it's been really a wonderful pleasure and privilege for my wife and I to come over. You know, it's really remarkable. I heard a couple sitting out in the lobby yesterday afternoon, The little girl came up to her mother out there, and she says, "Mother, it's all over." And she says, "Honey, what do you mean it's all over?" She says, "John and I have broken our engagement." And she says, "Well, honey, what's the matter? I thought you were very madly in love with John." She says, "Well, Mother, I was, but it's all off now." She says, "What in the world is wrong?" She says, "Mother, John is an atheist. He don't believe there's a hell." And her mother looked over there and said, "That's all right, sugar. You marry him and we'll show him. We'll show him." You know, it's kind of like the girl that came in the office the other day and I granted her a divorce. And she'd been there before. I asked her, I said, "Well, now you've got your divorce, how does it make you feel?" She said, "Like a new man." You know, that's really going to it. You know, right after I'd been elected judge for about a year, I'd had quite a few little cases appealed up to the state Supreme Court, and it'd all been affirmed, if you know what I mean. They found out that the old boy was right for a change. And all of a sudden, it dawned on me what the truth of the matter was. I wasn't that smart. But I turned around and I ordered a beautiful black silk robe, like the judges wear. And I ordered it with a full flowing sleeve length, you know, and all the way down to the floor, and a beautiful, and made it in a female motif. And the boys asked me, "What in the world are you going to do with that, Judge?" I said, "I'm going to give it to my wife. She has reversed more decisions of mine than any other damn court in the United States." But she has. You know, had a young fella up in the court. Let me give you a little of this story here. I was raised over in Middle Georgia, son of a Methodist steward, the old Methodist church. We used to call them stewards. I never did get to be chairman of the board of stewards. I made the chairmanship for the board of ministries, brother, but I couldn't make the board of stewards. I'm glad they changed the name. I don't think I ever would have made it. But my father was chairman of the board of stewards in my first recollection of the church. My mother was a Sunday school teacher, and I was an ardent member of the church. At 16, I started teaching kids in Sunday school. I like the old man and the young man in business together who hired, were getting ready to hire a beautiful young secretary. And she came in for consultation. And the older member of the firm looked at the young fella and he said, "Listen, now, you know, it's time now for us to show her what's right and what's wrong." The young fella said, "Okay, boss, you show her what's wrong and I'll show her what's right. We'll get this thing right." So I taught those kids, I thought, along a wonderful line. Time passed, I married one of my mother's students in Sunday school. I passed the bar examination and started working in the law practice in 1930. And that's 42 years ago. I look every inch of that age and I feel it too. But we had a wonderful life. I met and married this beautiful young lady, and we had a fine life for quite a few years. I was in the district attorney's office after my second year in the law practice. I was assistant prosecuting attorney. Yes, I sent men to the electric chair. I prosecuted men for violations of law. I did the job that I was supposed to do, and I did it with vigor and enthusiasm because I thought that that's the way I had to get up in the world, was to win the cases. I tried hard. There were no rules to go by other than the rule of knock down and drag out. And we practice these rules in all our affairs as we try to practice the principles of AA in all our affairs. I drank a lot of liquor. The meaner I got in the courtroom, the more liquor it took at night to put me to sleep. And I think there's a lot of them ought to get drunk every night. Today, a lot of these so-called prosecuting attorneys. Because their conscience ought to hurt. It ought to gouge pretty heavy on their conscience. But I came along and we had a wonderful relationship as far as the bar was concerned. We became a little bit estranged toward one another. My wife began to see a little different from what I did. I began to drink too much. I drank too often, too much, and I became an alcoholic. I possibly was an alcoholic on my first drink. I have no idea. I know very little about the etiology of alcoholism. All I know is if you drink enough of it long enough, it'll affect you. I know it affected my social life, my personal life, my moral life, my mental life. It affected me in every way. I went down up pretty fast, then I started down. My wife objected to, she had to go to work. She objected to make a living and me drinking up what little I made. She didn't like to see me going to hell in a bucket, so to speak, and she cautioned me about it. And I thought she was sending these preachers coming and the good men in the church and the good men in the profession that I was in. And they all said, "Dear, you're drinking too much liquor." I said, "No, it's my business. And when I get to drinking too much, I'll stop." They said, "Well, please put the brakes on a little bit. You're showing it." And people begin to go around the street to hire a lawyer. And or down the hall or up the steps, somewhere except my office. The people would ask me, said, "Dear, you used to represent old John over there, and now he's getting Colonel So-and-so to represent him." I said, "Yeah, the damn rascal owes me, and he won't pay me." And that was as big a lie as he could have told, because he had probably paid me, and I didn't appear to represent him. I began to do those things. I began to be afraid. Began to run. I was yellow. I couldn't take it unless I could see through that bottle. Everything in life became a necessity for alcohol. I'd take in a dollar, it meant a dollar's worth of booze. It didn't mean a loaf of bread or a piece of meat or a glass of milk or a house rent, light bill, or anything of this type. It was solid booze itself or nothing else. Well, this lasted quite a while. We lived together 9.5 years. Finally, she and I had a little party there one afternoon. I was pretty angry. She told me she had some papers drawn up and wanted me to sign them. I said, "No, hell, not me. No." I said, "Honey, don't make this mistake. You will never get a good fella like me again." I really thought that she wouldn't. She didn't. She got a nice guy the next time. But she and I couldn't see it. And finally, I said, "Well, now, we own a little house here. Of course, we got a good-sized mortgage on a little bitty house. But we've got furniture and stuff, and what are we going to do with it?" She said, "Bill, I'm going to treat you right. We're going to divide the house." I said, "Well, that's wonderful, sugar." She said, "Well, I tell you what, I'm going to give you half of it." I said, "Well, that's fine. Which half?" And I could see myself getting a little back room, you know, and then staying sober for a few weeks and work my way up back to the master room, you know. And the next thing you know, she says, "I'm going to take the inside and you the outside." And that's the way it works. Now, I've gone rather hurriedly over the first few years of my alcoholism. I don't want to go into a blow-by-blow description of this thing. I was down in Bradenton. My brother was the mayor down there. And I gave the keys to the city, to Miss America, and then promptly tripped over the train of a dress fell out on the floor and they throwed me over the banisters of the old pagoda out there. And that was embarrassing to my brother, at least. And but I did make a beautiful presentation speech of the keys to the city. I was over in Orlando, and my brother was out of town. You see, the yellow part comes in again. I waited till brother left town, and I picked the stem winder. Had a boy named Albert, a black boy named Albert, working with me. Albert was a wonderful boy. He picked over 100 boxes of oranges every day, and I'd give him, he'd have $25 coming, he'd only draw 5. And I kept wondering why he only drew 5, and then he got all his money on Saturday. Well, I found out one Saturday because my brother was out of town, and I said, Albert, would you like to have a drink? He said, yes, sir. The Four Roses, right across the street, and get us a pint. Well, he bought the fourth pint, and we were still sitting there drinking, when the telephone rang, and my sister-in-law called me to come to the house. I went home, and I was pretty well loaded. She said, we have company tonight, and you have to serve as the master of the house. I said, all right, sugar, I'll do it. But I'm drunk. And I don't think I ought to do it. She says, you'll have to. I went in and the maid tonight didn't disturb my tranquility. But this maid on this evening, I'm left-handed. And I drink coffee left-handed. Now, I eat with my right hand, but I drink coffee with this hand. And I want you to remember this part. I pour the coffee across and I sip on it. And after a while, that beef and biscuit, I hadn't had a drink in quite a while, gave me a tremendous appetite, and I got more beef and biscuit in my mouth than I could swallow. Easy. I said, well, my biscuit is, my coffee is cool now, and I'll wash it now. I reached over, and the cup wasn't there. It had been moved and filled up. I snatched it back across in a heat of anger, and I grabbed the cup, and thinking it was still cool, I got a big slug of hot coffee. It was so hot, I couldn't drink it. And I got strangled. And then I sneezed. I can see the lady at the far end of the table take her glasses off and get the biscuit. And I said, y'all excuse me. And you know, not the first one objected. But then I learned a very good lesson, and I want all of you that don't already know it to profit by my experience then. I went into my bedroom, and knowing that something was going to happen, not knowing what, I had put a fist under my window in the subway. None of you ever did that, I'm sure. But I reached and I couldn't find it. Finally, I hooked my big feet in the windowsill and let myself down. I broke the seal on the fist, turned it up, and got a big mouthful of liquor. And do you know, you can't drink liquor upside down? You can't do it. I wasted 2 mouthfuls of the finest liquor you ever saw. Finally, I got a good slug, filled my mouth, crawled back in, and then swallowed. But it was a wonderful experience. About 1 o'clock in the morning or 2, somewhere along in there, I heard a ruckus in the back of the house. And I knew my brother had come home. And I heard a high-pitched, shrill voice, female voice, say, either he goes or I go. And I knew then no Bill was going home. I left Orlando. I thought so. I got in jail in Jacksonville. I got in jail in Waco. And I got in jail in Lyons, Georgia, 40 miles beyond my hometown. Now, brother, I was going. I don't know how I got there. But, you know, it's a wonderful thing how travel will broaden somebody. I learned a lot about these things. I remember something happened over in Alabama. And that's one of our neighboring states of the Georgia and of Mississippi. When the Catholic priest was going through and his car broke down and he was pretty hot and he stopped at this old Alabama farmer's house and he says, pardon me, friend, but can I have a cool drink of water? And the old farmer looks at him, he had on his clerical collar and coat. The old man looks at him and says, don't think so. He turned around and walked off. Well, the priest looked at him and he looked inside the door and he saw a picture of the Pope framed hanging in the hall of this old Alabama farmhouse. He said, friend, why do you refuse me a cool drink of water on a hot summer day? And you have the picture of the Pope, the head of my church, framed on your wall inside your hall there. He says, is that who that is? He says, yes. Why? He said, well, that damn salesman told me that it was a picture of Harry Truman in his Masonic robe. and you know, I felt that way. I really did. When I got home, I was in a terrible condition. Now, catch this. I'm going to be very brief about my alcoholism. I got off the bus. The bus driver had to get me out of jail in line and bring me home. I was without a dime, and what few clothes my brother had given me, I didn't have. I lost on the bus somewhere. I walked to the courthouse where my brother's attorneys were, and I tried to borrow the price of a drink. And I saw that wouldn't work. I tried to borrow the price of a breakfast. And I made up my mind to buy a breakfast, a food with it. I couldn't get it. You see, I had put the bite on these fellas too many times. I had been in the city jail of my hometown 130 times for drunkenness. I hadn't slept in a bed except the ones I stole from the hotel. You know, that's easy to get a bed in a hotel. I doubt if you could do it here, but the old-fashioned hotels we had at home had a transom. You know the old-fashioned transom over the door? You go up and you knock at the door, and nobody answers. You pull up, and if there's no sign of habitation in there, you push the transom, and they always open with enough pressure. You climb over, and you go to bed. If they catch you, you got a bed at the city hall. If they don't catch you, you got to find bed in the hotel. and it works. It'll work. You get a bed, I guarantee you, you'll get a bed. But I walked all over my town. I went to the big men in my church, and I asked them to loan me the price of breakfast, a meal, 6 cents. No. I said, fellas, really now, I'm serious. I'd like to do something about it. For God's sake, help me. I'm on the downgrade now. I need help. I had never had that approach before. They said, no, Bill, you've gone too far. We can't help you. I walked down the street, and the girls that were in school with me were grown men, and they had children. And they'd get the kids and pull them up close to them and walk around to keep from getting too close to me. You see, I was getting a bath at the flowing well between town and the river. I was stealing soap out of the filling station toilet and washing my clothes and myself with this soap. Yes, I was the same man that strutted up and down in front of the jury and begged the jurors for a man's life because of his past misconduct. And for something that he did. Yes, I was the same self-sufficient young man who condemned others for doing wrong and drank liquor to celebrate a victory at night. Confirmed some of your suspicions, possibly, about my profession. But I walked that town over. I went to the big men in my church. I had long since quit the church. I was drunk one day. Fell flat on my face on the sidewalk while I was still teaching Sunday school. Two kids carried me home. The next morning I went down to teach, and there were those two kids. You know what happened? I resigned. I told them I had to quit. And they said, "Mr. Bill, we love you. Don't quit. Stay with us." I said, "No, you don't understand." But they did understand that I chose alcohol in preference to them. And it hurt. It hurt those kids. I didn't know how bad. I walked around and I couldn't get a meal this day. Finally, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I walked into the bar room. As I opened the door, there's old Bill. "Come on in here, boy, and have a drink with us." I said, "Fellas, maybe I better not. I think this thing's gone far enough. Maybe I better not take a drink." And they insisted, and I said, "Well, one more hurt." So I took one. I took two. Three. They said, "Bill, have you had supper?" I said, "No, I haven't." They said, "What are you going to eat?" I said, I don't know. "I ain't had breakfast yet." And they said, "Well, come on with us." And they carried me across the street to a little cafe, and we had supper. And they said, "Where are you staying?" I said, "I haven't made any arrangements yet. I haven't got any money." They said, "Here, here's $5. You can get a bed." I said, "Fellas, I can't go down there and register. They won't let me in the hotel." You see, they didn't understand the finesse that you have to get in a hotel. You've got to have a reputation for paying your bills and for being clean. Sitting a gang of drunks in your room singing "Sweet Adeline" at 4 o'clock in the morning. It just don't work, you know. And they didn't understand why I couldn't get a bed. So they went around and registered in their name, came back and gave me the key. Said, "We'll meet you in the morning, we'll get you a job, we'll let you have." "Thank you." I sold the room. I kept the $5 and I bought some wine. I did drink a little of the great stuff. You know, our Italian Swiss Colony sherry wine was a wonderful nectar. But I bought a little wine and I slept under the railroad trestle that night. And it was a wonderful experience because we had a freshet come in that night, the river. You know, we were just below Lake Sinclair and it had a big rain and they let the water off at the dam up there and the river rose. And just below the trestle where I slept was the sewer where it emptied into the river. And during the night, I must have been riding one of those wonderful nightmares. I fell off of the trestle basement, or base rather, and I grabbed my liquor bottle with one hand and a rock with the other. And I realized, and the water was up along here, and I realized that I had to let go of one of those things. So the rock had to go. And as I floated by the sewer, I pulled the old corn cob out of the bottle, the cob back in, put it in my shirt, and then began to think about getting out. And I felt until I hit a willow limb, and I pulled up onto the bank, and I crawled and went to sleep. It quit raining during the night, and I creaked over, kind of crusted over, you know. And the next morning, I walked down to the beautiful 20th century room. You know, that's one we had these blue tinted mirrors in. And the boys looked at me and caught me this way and led me through and turned the water hose on me in the backyard. You know, that was a terrible experience. Then I had to lay out there in the sun and dry before I could come in. The next night, I had nowhere to sleep. So I grew up, you know, we have a sanctum sanctorum of the Holy of the Holies. All of us have one somewhere. But mine was the coat room. And I went up, and I went to bed. I took all the cushions out of the jury box and laid them on the long table in front of the judge's stand. Had these old long blade lazy fans that turn, you know, blow the flies off. And if you don't think you need a fan to blow flies off, try going without a bath for about 30 days and wallow in the river. And the second night I used this sumptuous place, they didn't like it, and they locked the door to the courtroom door. I was very indignant. There I was, an attorney at law, an officer of that court, a member of the local bar, the Bar Association for the Circuit, a taxpayer, a citizen of that community, locked out of my courtroom. So I went up to the balcony and walked down to the middle of it. I dropped over into the courtroom, and somehow I straddled that fan blade. Well, it broke. And I felt a little twinge, but it didn't bother me. I go back into the jury room then, and I turn on the gas, take a drink, little space heater, and then I begin to look for a match. That's while I found one. And I squatted down in front of the heater, and I struck that match. That could be the reason I don't have any hair. I went through a table up against the wall on the other side of the room. But, you know, that sobered me up just a little bit. I decided that maybe I better cut the gas off. So I turned the gas off, and then in the preponderance of precaution, I turned to open the window. And that was the most useless gesture I ever made. There wasn't no framing left in the window sill. It was all gone. But I struck a match, and then I turned the gas back on. And I curled up and went to sleep. The next morning, the janitor woke me up and said, "You better get the hell out of here before the sheriff comes." I got up and I walked through two blocks to my hometown. And believe it or not, not a human being said a word. I walked into the ballroom, and everybody started laughing. I said, "What in the hell are you laughing at?" They said, "Come in." And they said, "Stand up on your feet here." You know, I had an office in the ballroom. It was the last booth. And I got in this little office, and I stood up on the seat, and they turned me around back to the mirror. And they said, "Look." And I looked back there, and there wasn't nothing but me. Now, I had heard the expression about showing you can. But, brother, I did it. And it really embarrassed me until I could get in the alley and find a little rusty shingle nail. And I hooked it up back under my belt. And a couple of drinks later, I felt no twinge of remorse. That's a funny thing. But these things, I tell you, and they are true, they happened to me. I went to the church, and with apologies to my good pastor friend, I was carried there. A man bought me a shave and a haircut, and I always accused him of it, a de-lousing job, too. He bought me a pair of khaki pants and a khaki shirt and a suit of underwear and a pair of socks, and I used Atlanta Constitution for a shoe sole. I still think it's a good one. And I entered the church. And there, believe it or not, I met the first man who knew what was wrong with Bill White. Bishop Arthur Moore, a bishop in the Georgia Conference. He's retired now, but still living. My pastor at that time was a very close friend later. They carried me down to the altar of that church, and we all knelt. There's no service going on, just my friend, the preacher, the bishop, and I. And they prayed for me, each one of them. And then it got awful quiet. And I was just like this. I'd been drunk 9.5 years, 5 of it without a job, bumming, and doing the other things necessary to get liquor. And you know what that is. And it got awful quiet. And I looked up to see what was going on. You know, you're suspicious. And the bishop looked at me and he says, "It's your time to pray, Bill." I bowed my head and I lifted my voice. And I didn't mean it to be blasphemy or sacrilege. I said, "God, help me to get out of this place." And I started for the door. The preacher grabbed me. "No, you can't go. You got to promise me you'll attend church service tonight." I said, "Man, what you call me? Let me go." And he said, "No, I want you to promise you to attend services tonight." The bishop put his arm around me and he said, "No, I don't want him here tonight." I looked at him like I thought he might be crazy, but he was making good sense right then. The preacher asked him why. He said, "Two good reasons. One is that in his condition, he wouldn't hear or understand anything I had to say." See, that made sense. The second one is, he'd have a running and barking fit right in the middle of my sermon and scare the congregation half to death. And he was right again. And I tow out of there, and I run all the way back to the bar room, and I had 50 cents in cash left. I laid it on the slab. I said, "A 50-cent shot of sherry, please, quick." And the man saw the nervous condition I was in, and he filled a tea glass full, a beer glass full, and gave it to me. And I downed it. And just as I set the glass down, my friend, who had been my benefactor, had bought me the cleanup job and the clothes, walked in the door, and he said, "No, you're not drinking again after what I've done for you this morning." "Yes, I'm drinking. I had to have it." "Now, you don't understand." He says, "The hell I don't. You're not worth a damn. I've done all I could for you, and I've done all this, and you don't appreciate it. You're a damn ingrate." And he says, "Don't ever ask me for another thing." And I looked at him, I said, "By God, I didn't ask you this." And then I was going to say more, but I stopped. He walked out. It broke my heart. Tears came in my eyes. And I bummed another drink to salve my conscience a little bit. You see, I couldn't do anything without alcohol. I couldn't even cry or curse or fight without a drink. I couldn't pray without a drink. Alcohol had become the center core of my life. For the next 10 days, that was April the 1st, 1949, for the next 10 days, I drank. I drank to blot out and to push back into oblivion all trace of humanity, all trace of life itself. And I couldn't do it. One afternoon, the night of April 10, 1949, I weighed a great big fat 111 pounds, 6'2" tall. And that's only 80 pounds less than I weigh now. And you could have, and I would have blown away with the wind. A man came in and said, "Bill, you need a drink." I said, "Brother, no truer words have ever been spoken." He says, "You need food." I said, "That's true too. But after the drink." He says, "You need medication." I said, "Right, but after the drink." And he says, "You need a place to stay and clothes to wear and something to do. Somebody to look after you." I said, "That's right, but let's cut out the conversation and start the drinking." And he said, "Well, I will." And he had to go. And he walked a block and come back. You see, we had a dry county. You couldn't buy liquor within less than a block of where you were. And it didn't matter where you were. I used to prosecute those fellas, the bootleggers back in those days, back in the heyday. When I was really going, all I had to do was let them know the liquor was out. And then I had to leave the office and go to the back of the building and come back. And there'd be a thief sitting in the office, in the district attorney's office. It wasn't any trouble to get liquor. And you can see how easy it should be for a man to drift into alcoholism. But now, the man brought me the pint and he poured half of it into a glass. Now, during these trips to the city hall, I've got the scars on both wrists and both ankles, and I hope I'll always feel them just a little bit every now and then. You know, they didn't have the niceties of hospitalization treatment in the city hall. They'd tie one foot at this end of the bed, one foot over here, one hand here, and one there, and then let you act like a dog needed weaning, laying on the bed, and contort, and scream and holler when the boys got after you. And they didn't pay any attention. One of my friends come through there one evening, saw the condition I was in. I was tired. The blood was running from both wrists and both ankles. And he walks up the hall and he says, "Officer, how about letting my buddy out of there? I'll carry him to the hospital." He said, "Let the drunk son of a bitch die." That's another story. I got him later. I got him. But these things begin to happen to me. That liquor was sitting on that table in that little booth. And I went back to wash my face and hands. And I couldn't see. As a matter of God, I was going blind. And there was a pool room between the bathroom and the main part of the beer parlor. And I heard pool balls clicking. And I opened the door, and I couldn't see. And I thought, "I am blind. I know you can't see pool in the dark." And I reached back, and I felt, and there was an old broken mirror there. And I reached up, and I felt the light bulb, and it was hot. And I knew it was burning. And I gouged my eyes out, and pushed and pulled until I got them open. And they were swollen shut, and I could see. And the man I saw in that little dim-lit toilet in that broken mirror was a horrible thing. And I cursed him, and I cursed the God that put him there. And I claimed that God put me there. I cursed God for doing these things. But thank God that I recognized there was a God. Although I cursed him, I was conscious of the fact that there was a God. I walked out of that bar in the beer parlor, toilet, and I walked up to the front, and I pushed the glitter glass back. I said, "Big boy, you are not going in my stomach tonight." And the liquor looked at me, and he said, "Oh, yeah." I looked around, and that liquor was talking. Now, I've had wall talk. I've had long conversations with snakes and lizards, but I had never had a conversation with a glass of liquor before. And that liquor said, "Look at your hand." Oh, it was pretty rough, you know. And I tried to hold him up close to him and made my whole body jerk. And says, "You drink me. And when this night is over, if you die during the night, you'll be comfortable. And you'll be happy and contented. You won't know anything about it. But if you don't drink me, and you go out of this bar room, you don't have anywhere to go. You'll have to sleep in the bushes somewhere, under a warehouse with the wharf rats. Or you'll have to go somewhere. And when you lay down, and the monkeys come, and the snakes crawl, and the ants and the spiders and the lizards crawl in your nose, your mouth, your eyes, and your ears, and you start to screaming, you're going to wish to hear you to drink me. You remember this, just one little drink." And I began to rationalize and say, "My God, that may happen again." And I looked down and I saw the scars on those wrists. And I felt the necessity for someone to be close at a time like this. I said, "One drink." And I started to that bar, or to that liquor there. And three men walked in the front door of that ballroom. Call it God. Call it what you please. To me, the God that I understand, sat those three men in that door. One was a painter, and God bless him. One was a barber, and one was a carpenter. And God bless all of them, but that painter, I love him. Those three men asked me if I didn't want to do something about my liquor drinking and about my life. And I said, fellas, I'd love to, but it's too late. I'm gone. I'm over the hill. I'm on the way out now. Take your effort, your time, and put it somewhere else, where it would be appreciated and where you can do some good. They said, you let us be the judge of that. And they came, and I went. Went down to a little building, went upstairs into a little dimly lit room, and they had a sign on the door, 24-hour club. And I went up there, and they propped me up in a chair beside the wall. It was about 10 or 12. I had gotten them out of jail, or they had gotten me out. And they were each one clean. And each one had a job. Each one had his family back. Each one was a working, functioning member of the community in which we lived. And I said, my God, I'd love to have what you boys got. And they said, Bill, all you got to do is stay with us. I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. And I didn't know I said this for 15 years. Tell me now that I said it. Said, if you boys will stay with me, I'll stay with you. Thank God. April the 10th, 1949. I hope that somebody got some benefit from that glass of liquor sitting on the table in the 20th Century Room on Madison Street in Dublin, Georgia. Because that's my last drink, and I didn't take it. Said life has not been a bed of roses since this time. I've had a nice time. You know, my friends told me, said, Bill, you used to play baseball, basketball, tennis, track. I said, yeah. Pretty fair, country boy and all of them. Says, you know, in your baseball days, when you were a rookie in the Florida State League, I said, yeah, I remember that. And you get two strikes on you, and the best pitcher in the league was in there. And you didn't have much chance. You were a poor hitter to start with. And you looked around and you wished somebody to take your last strike. For today, you can't make it in this town. You are washed up. The people have no respect and no love and consideration for you at all. You've got to move from Dublin to some other town. And an old drunk sitting there said, no, no. He said, if you lost a $20 bill in Dublin, would you go to Nathan to look for it? And you know, I thought it made sense. I dug in. They gave me a job with the city. I'll never forget the little clerk face the first payday when I went around to draw my paycheck. I said, how about decorating the hardware, silver? She said, she thought she recognized my voice. She looked down under that little... I'm grading up there, you know. Said, my God, it is him. And she shelled out a little pay envelope. And she gave it to me, and I felt mighty good about it. I had made an honest dollar. Because by God, I worked for that paycheck. I really put out for it. Time passed and progressed, as it will. About 2 years later, this little job was in very dogging in the tax business. I got into the tax field along with my little law practice. You know, I'll tell you, if you don't know, that you'll find out the hard way. A drunk won't hire a drunk for a lawyer. I found it out the hard way. They will use you, but they won't hire you and they won't pay you. Because they're afraid if they pay you, you'll get drunk and you can't go to court, see? And they just logged that you haven't got any use for you. But I started into the law practice. And one day, a very, very beautiful and lovely lady came in. Well, after a little consultation, and she came back, and I met her three lovely children, two boys and a girl. And she came back into the office, and about 4:30, I asked her what time her bus ran. She said 5:00. She lived about 12 miles south of town. I said, all right, so about 5 minutes to 5, I tore up everything I had done so I'd have to start over again. But she was close. And at a little after 5, after the bus had run, I said, my goodness, I made you miss your bus. Can I carry you home? She said, I reckon so. I got to get there somehow. So I borrowed a car. I didn't have much to ride in by this time. I carried this lovely lady home, and on the way home, I said, sugar, you reckon your kids would love to come to town and go to the drive-in and get a hamburger and a shake-up, maybe a baby Ruth and a little juicy fruit chewing gum? She says, I don't know. You can ask them. So I did, and they did, and we came to town. And for 12 months, I drove in, hamburgered, shook up, baby Ruth, and juicy fruited them three kids. Then I asked her to marry me. She said, why don't you propose to the ones you've been coating? We called the kids in. It was about 10 o'clock at night, and they come in sleepy-eyed, you know, tired, wore out from an afternoon of play. And I said, kids, how would you all like to have me for daddy from now on? Their eyes lit up, and all you could see was a reflection, a hamburger, in their eyes. And by God, they've been eating them ever since, too. Yeah, I'll tell you right now. But they voted unanimously. And I looked at her, and she said, well, if I say no, I couldn't live here any longer. I'd have to go along. So we were married in 1953. In 1956, a wonderful, not easily a blessing. In 1956, a wonderful boy came along. Now, to think that from 56 till now, he could grow a heap bigger than his daddy, it's kind of hard to do. But that boy is a little over 6'2", 185 pounds, and every inch of him a man. 2 years later, another boy came along. He's about 5'11". String bean, weigh about 120 or 30 pounds. He's like his daddy. He's going long-legged and skinny. But they are the byproducts. You know, I heard a man in AA say not long ago, if I could just find happiness in AA. And he was sitting on his chin, criticizing what the boys that were working on here in AA were doing. I said, friend, excuse this personal reference. I said, happiness is not a station that you arrive at. Happiness is a method of travel. It's a byproduct of good living and of hard work. And that insulted him when I said something about hard work. And he quit AA for a while and fixed his drunk, and now he's back and he's in pretty good graces now. But we've had a wonderful life. My people and my community accepted the old drunk bum. I asked them to give me a job, a prosecuting attorney in the little city court. We call it really a state court. They changed the name of it now. And I had to fight the establishment. But I pitched in, and they gave it to me. Now, Bill White didn't get elected. Don't get me wrong. Sobriety got elected. Decency and morality. Those people gave me that job. And some of the very first men I had to prosecute was that barber and that damn carpenter. They got me out of the barroom, and that painter stayed in my hair for 18 years drunk. But he'd been sober for 5. It took me 18 years to get my sponsor sober. But I got it for 5 years. I buried the carpenter, and I buried the barber, and they died. But alcoholics and bulkies. We try. We wait for results. We don't always get them, but we never stop working. We keep trying. Later, my people gave me back the same little job without opposition. That was wonderful. Sobriety done. Then I didn't like the judge because he was too hard on drunk. And I ran against him. And the folks gave sobriety another job. And then I began to find what it meant to judge a drunk. The job. It's hard. It's heartbreaking. But I never sentenced one to the public works camp yet. And God being my helper, I don't want to. I won't say that I won't. And then 4 years ago, I decided that my kids deserved a better break in life. And I knew they were getting older and soon be time to go to college. And I decided maybe that the folks could put up with me in a little bit better job. And I couldn't make up my mind what to do until one day a drunk came in the court. And I said, "My God, Jim, you've been here now for 8 years I've been prosecuting, 4 years I've been judge, and you're right back here again. What in the world am I going to do about it? What can I do?" He said, "Well, Judge, it ain't my fault you ain't been promoted." So I tried promotion to the little circuit court, and the folks gave it to me. And on June the 14th, I finally made up my mind to come to the... I'd already accepted this. You know, we alcoholics are egotists, too. I figured I wasn't going to have any opposition. The hell I didn't know it, I kept my fingers crossed. And on June the 14th, when the time passed and I'd had no opposition to the job I have, sobriety had won another victory. And I said, "Yes, I won't have to call them now and tell them I can't come. I'll fulfill my obligation to Alcoholics Anonymous." From which came my life and my entire family, my future. I called my boys, one of them alcoholic and the other one anonymous. And I tell you this, they are really there. One's little Bill and one's little Ed. And they are wonderful boys. And they are products of Alcoholics Anonymous. They are products of sobriety. They are a source of pride. Well, once before, there was no pride. They are a source of joy, where before was only heartache and sorrow. They are a source of ambition, where before I had no desire for anything except a bottle of liquor. These things are the byproducts of Alcoholics Anonymous. They are the proof of the pudding of AA. I have nothing whatever else to lay claim to credit for except accepting Alcoholics Anonymous as a way of life. And I'm glad that I was here last night when Father Joe went over the 12 steps, because I knew I wouldn't have to do it tonight. Because that is my life, to the best of my ability. I have no panacea, no formula for you to go by, except get in there and pick. Go see the drunk. He'll wake you up all night, all hours of the night. And he'll call you, and he'll get sick, and hurt in your lap, and you got on your best clothes. And he'll wrestle with you, and he'll hurt you. He don't mean to. Just be a little careful. And finally, when you climb that circular stair, and you knock at the door, and nobody answers, keep knocking. Knock some more. And finally, you'll hear a noise. And a speaking noise as he opens that door. And the bleary eyes, and the tear-strained cheeks, and the trembling voice, he comes out and says, "Oh, what is it, Bill?" and you know you're dealing with a man, a human being, and not an animal. And you put your arm around him and say, come, boy, walk with me. As others made me walk with him. And as you see him get sober, oh, he'll flip and he'll flop sometimes. But the eventual goal is sobriety. Flips, yes, but they're not necessary. I've been one of the most fortunate people in the world. I didn't have a flip. They called me to come back and to teach Sunday school again. Yes, they did too, that old drunk bum. And you know the reason they did? If you don't have character enough for your conscience to bother you, you'll never become an alcoholic. Did you hear that? If you don't have character enough for your conscience to bother you, you'll never become an alcoholic. You'll just be a common drunk. It's that character, that strain of character in your blood and in your body that makes you realize that you are doing wrong, that you are hurting when you ought not to be hurting, that makes you wish to God that you hadn't done it, and makes you wish you could face your life, the public, your friends, without a drink. But you can't do it. And you wake up in the morning and you hear the brakes squeal in the yard and you jump. And you tell your wife, I'm not home. And you reach down by the bed and take a drink. And then in a few minutes when that liquor takes effect, you can walk out and see if it's a sheriff or who it is that don't make any difference. You can talk to him. But you can't do it without that drink. Because you've got character enough for your conscience to bother you. If you don't give a damn, you can walk right on out of there and never be ashamed or afraid. They called me back to teach Sunday school, and what happened? The first Sunday I walked in that Sunday school room, I looked, and there sat the son and the daughter of those two boys that carried me home that night. Yes, that's how long it's been since I went back to church. I couldn't say a word. Those kids said, Mr. Bill, we understand. Our daddy said you were the finest man that ever taught in our Sunday school. And we want you, and we love you, to teach us. And I still got that job. At that age, I don't have any longer, but I have others. It's a wonderful life. Yes, the same preacher. You know, in my church, they circulate. They keep the preachers moving. First thing you know, the preacher that was there the day I wish I wasn't came back to my hometown, and he came up and he said, Bill, I want you on the board of stewards. I said, I can't do it. I'm not worthy. He said, I think you are, and you are now on it. As an honorary member, I had you appointed as chairman of the Board of Social Concerns. And brother, he ought not to have done it, because I got a bunch of Methodists around here stirred up by liquor drink. I began to talk and tell him about it. I went from church to church all over my country. And I didn't tell anybody to quit drinking liquor because it was good for them. I went and I told them they ought to quit drinking liquor because if they didn't, they was going to look like me. And you know, a lot of them quit drinking liquor. They couldn't stand that pressure. I was kind of like the little fella that went into his mama's room one night and asked for a drink of water. She got up and got him a drink of water at 1 o'clock. She said, Mama, tell me a bedtime story. She looked at the clock. She said, what time is it, son? She said, it's 1 o'clock. She said, wait just a few minutes and Daddy will be home and tell us both one. You know, I was more or less in that position. But these things happen to you. I later became, and I say this in all humility, because Bill White didn't do any of it. Sobriety accomplished what little I had. Yes, I became chairman of that board of ministry. And I was awfully proud of that thing. I'm a lay speaker for my church. I love my work. I love my God. The God that I cursed, I praise. The God that I blamed, I turn in humble adoration to, and praise and thanksgiving. for being the one responsible for my conduct today. What little there is in this world for us to gain, it has to come through the power and greater than we are. I don't say these things to you telling you they are must in AA. I say to you they are must for Bill White. I find it necessary to thank my living God every morning for allowing me the privilege of waking up. And I earnestly ask that he give me the privilege of remaining sober this day and to do his will. And I never forget to thank him when I go to bed at night for the wonderful blessings of each day. I learned this in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned it as a way of life that's necessary. And when they gave me my first blue chip, I kept my first white and red chip. I still have those three chips. They are prized possessions of mine that I love and I shall cherish for the balance of my life. It's kind of like the boy that went to the doctor. I wanted to tell this on Charles Hester, but Charles, I don't think Charles here tonight. He might have come in. Good boy, Charles. Said that he went to Charles. And Carl examined him and he says, you need an operation. Have you ever been operated on before? He says, yes, sir. He says, what for? He says, $300. He says, what did you have? He says, $250. No, no, I don't mean it. He said, what was you said the bill was too damn high. I kind of see things. You know, one day, and pull it up there. They had a man come in, one of these flippant, smart aleck type fellas. And he came in, and the district attorney brought him up before the court. And the court asked him, do you ever work? He said, oh, yes, sir, Judge, I work. He said, well, where do you work? He said, well, when you work, and you work here and there, what do? He said, oh, this and that. He said, wait a minute now. When you work this and that, when you do this and that, when do you work? Nine. Judge, carry him to jail. Carry him to jail. As they started out of the courtroom, the fellow looked up and said, Judge, sir, when did I get out? Alcoholics Anonymous is a crossroad out my courthouse. And how do you by what we do? Some happen. Some people happen. What? But what we do, as members anonymous, will determine whether drunk shall be bitter or we can. Does the alcoholic, the sick alcoholic, a creature, in his own, made in his own image, deserve physical, moral? I think he does. Thank God somebody saw me do it. And I said, to carry them everywhere and whenever they help under the city's out of the hill, he's out to extend your hand in Christian consideration that this too is a human being as well as you. And for he needs or she needs this help. It's a challenge to each of us, individually and as groups. Sobriety is not a philosophy. Sobriety is a way of life. And the AA way of life makes it so much easier for us to live. And you know, I found out something else. AA is not for drunks. It's for people who don't want to stay drunk. It's not for better people. It's for people who want to live better. AA is a lot of things. Life was only this key for people who couldn't think before there was insanity. One day we lived in a world of despair, and we live in a world of beauty and of care. Care for one another. A finger of scorn, prison, and tongue of sick but it should during duty or land in ours. To extend the hand of friendship and fellowship and say, come, walk with me. As a member of my profession, I can only talk That's all I got. All sick alcohol. Could make a comment on how sick an alcoholic is. An alcoholic. It is. Time. Thanks. And once more. To some people, AA is an argument. Yes, you hear. I've heard it here today. Some people, AA. To some people, AA will perform. It is a wonderful experience. Life through brotherhood and tolerance. We're trying to close. Some realize by day, others by heart, passion, and care. First measure under the hand for others should be the standard of all of us. Measure our lives by that standard. What in our others we've done. Trying to find out the difference, and we couldn't find it. Another day I came home, facing on friends. I went to my church. I went on everybody I knew. And I couldn't get the price of a breakfast or a meal of any kind. Because I went out looking for a friend. But when I went out to be a friend, I found friends everywhere. I found those wonderful things. And wouldn't it be wonderful, and wouldn't Mississippi be a much more wonderful state to live in if each one of us was a more wonderful person to live beside. It's a challenge to us and a way of life. You know, I heard a lawyer in an argument one day, and I shouldn't quote my brothers too often, but this was so beautiful. That the principles of AA are as broad as the universe, as high as the heavens, as deep as eternity, and as well settled as the salvation of Almighty God. And that is AA. Let me read you, in closing, a very short little poem that I think symbolizes old Bill's life. There's no skill in easy sailing when the skies are clear and blue. There's no joy in merely doing things of which anyone can do. But there is some satisfaction that's mighty sweet to taste when you reach a destination that they said you'd never make. Isn't it wonderful that survive can accomplish so much with so little to work with? An old drunk, an accomplished liar, a thief, a man who had no respect for himself or his family or his profession, and can take him from the bottomless pit of despair and drunkenness and bring him back to normality, at least the stage of it, and to decency and to respect for himself and his fellow man. Now, you heard read when we first started tonight a portion of chapter 5 called How It Works. Let me read you my personal version of how it works. I read this in Leo Wakeman's column, the Atlanta Constitution, about 22 years ago. I made a copy of it. In each of you, I see a friend, one whose friendship knows no end. And so just for today, I'll try to do to others what you are to me. You stopped and turned and took me by the hand and steadied me till I could stand. And then until I walked alone, let go my fingers one by one. You did not say to me, do this or do thus. You said quite simply, walk with us. I tried, and when I lifted up, my eyes could see the same vision that made you free. And we walk together now, a present band, which waits for me if I should feel my hand with the trembling fingers of one whose spirit must also break the bend and teach him softly what it means to have and to be a friend. And so just for today, I will let others see what each of you has meant for me. Thank you so much, and God bless you.